Willow O'Farrell, Brad Heck, and Congresswoman Gwen Moore, welcome to Lake Effect. Thank you all for taking the time to speak with me today.
Oh, it's just exciting for me to be here.
Yeah, nice too. Thanks for having us.
So Willow and Brad, your recent film, Sisters Rising, is really a call to action and a portrait of a lot of very strong women who are acting in solidarity in their demand for tribal sovereignty and self-determination. And this is, of course, surrounding the really terrible fact that violence against Indigenous women in the U.S. is so much higher than other demographics. So to start, how did you both become aware of the issue of disproportionate violence against Native women?
About 6 years ago, we ran across Patty Stonefish's crowdfunding campaign online for her Indigenous women's self-defense courses. And through her project, we became aware of the high levels of violence facing Native American women. And we had no idea until we found her work. Even though we're feminists and we care about these issues, we had never heard that Native women are, is it three times more likely to experience sexual violence than all other demographics of women in the US? And so we are documentary filmmakers. So we offered to make some work with her. And we ended up kind of meeting this constellation of incredible women, mostly based in North Dakota and also a little bit in Minnesota. And it turned into Sisters Rising, and kind of this, just by listening to the women that we were working with, we kind of let them guide the shape of the documentary. And it really became more and more clear that tribal sovereignty is one of the cornerstones to ending violence against Indigenous women.
I think one of the things we learned from Patty and as we were doing more research was this 86% of all the sexual violence against Native women is perpetrated by non-Native men, and actually mostly white men, making them the only demographic in the United States where there is more interracial violence than intraracial violence. All other demographics, a white woman is more likely to be abused by a white man, and the only exception to the U.S. is Native women.
So before we do get into some of the jurisdiction and legal implications of these facts, it sounds like this project grew pretty organically from something you both noticed and naturally stemmed of working with multiple people. So was it hard to establish trust with your subjects, or was this a natural growth? And because it is a very harrowing subject and people are very brave in sharing their stories. And with all documentaries, there needs to be a good relationship between the director and the subjects.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a trust-building process, especially we didn't know anyone besides Patty when we got started. And we actually went to the Fort Berthold Indian Reservation in northwestern North Dakota, which is in the middle of the oil Bakken oil boom. And Don White was kind of the linchpin of our doc, I think, in getting access to and trust with other women in the film. Don White, Sergeant Don White in the film, is a tribal law enforcement officer. She's an Army veteran, total badass warrior for her people. And she definitely dressed us down when we first met her. She was grilling us up, down, and sideways. She was very suspicious of journalists parachuting into her community, trying to get a story, sell a headline, and get out, you know? And she was like, what do these headlines do for me and my people? They're not doing anything for us, you know, which is a really good point. And we, by explaining, actually, you know, this is not selling a headline. Documentary films take years. We didn't know it was going to take 6 years. But she liked that it was a long-term project that would take a lot of thoughtfulness and was really about putting Native women front and center. Because a lot of times I think, and Gwen Moore, I'm sure, can, you know, speak to this, governmental agencies or different kind of structures of power are trying to maybe help people, but they're not always going to the source, the grassroots source, to find out what people really want and need for their own health. And I think a lot of times Native women have been overlooked and aren't being asked directly, what should happen? You know, what should we do to end this violence? Native women are the experts of their own experiences. They know what needs to be done. And so once Dawn White trusted us, it was sort of, she started pulling in other women to work in the film, on the film with us. And it was kind of like a cascade, sort of a whisper network of meeting all these incredible women.
So Congresswoman, to bring you into this, you are featured in the documentary with your testimonials highlighted. So when did you become aware of these issues facing Native women around the country? And I'm hoping, can you explain the federal precedent of the Oliphant decision by the Supreme Court in 1978 that a lot of this revolves around?
Well, again, thank you for letting me appear. And I just love the work of these artists to really stand up and elevate the plight of Native American women. You know, I, like them, was the author of the Violence Against Women Act. I was the had been the co-chair of the Bipartisan Women's Caucus, and I've personally experienced domestic violence and very much leaned into the domestic violence space. And I was the prime author of the Violence Against Women Act reauthorization. And of course, that was, I thought, going to be fairly pro forma. And here we were, 2010, 2011 cycle. I introduced it. And some of the people who were involved in delivering the services, the domestic violence advocates, victim advocates, district attorneys' offices, they all come together every year for the reauthorization and talk about best practices. And what they found is that there were not adequate protections for LGBTQ women, for women of immigrant status, and Native American women. So when you talk about Native American women experiencing domestic violence 3.5 times more than other women, you wonder, what is it? Is it something about Native American women that they attract all these predators? No, it's because they have no protection legally for domestic violence committed on tribal lands, particularly if it's done by a non-Native man. The Oliphant decision was a Supreme Court ruling that determined that tribes did not have criminal jurisdiction over non-Indian perpetrators. And apparently, a whole lot of white men knew about Oliphant, because you literally could have a date with a Native woman outside the reservation, drag her back onto tribal land, beat her up, rape her, and there were no consequences. There might be a federal jurisdiction 500 miles away. And so therefore, it was never prosecuted. We had testimony from women whose non-Native husbands or boyfriends would beat them up and then call the tribal authorities or Barney Frank, the sheriff, and stand there and say, now, what are you going to do about it? And so what we did with the 2013 bill was to provide some protections for Native women, some authority for tribal in the narrow area of domestic violence. And in this last cycle of improvements, we have Deb Holland, first Native American woman to be nominated and then elected. She and Sharice Davis, Native American women elected to Congress. They added many more amendments to strengthen that particular part of the bill. Other elements of being able to retrieve guns from violent predators. And that bill is being held up in the United States Senate now. But let me just say, going back to 2013, that was a yeoman's struggle. And the big issue was that they did not want white men to be subject to the jurisdiction of tribal courts. And that Oliphant decision, I mean, they you know, said, Gwen, just take that part out and the bill will pass. No, we're not giving up Native women in order to pass this bill.
I imagine a lot of people would be very surprised to hear that people cannot be held accountable for crimes they commit on Native land. And one place that you, the filmmakers, go to is Fort Berthold, and it has three affiliated tribes. So, Willow and Brett, how do you both describe this place, and what do you think are the most common misconceptions about Indian reservations?
So I think Sergeant Don White, the tribal police officer profiled in Sisters Rising, would say that she's sick and tired of the misconception that Indian reservations are lawless places. But the fact is, then she also says, on the other hand, there are people who, you know, non-Native men who basically spit on her at the casino and tell her you can't do anything about it, you know. And so she's kind of expressing two different things, which is that actually, you know, we sign nation-to-nation agreements in the treaties with Native American tribes, and they should be respected. Fundamentally, there should be tribal sovereignty and tribal jurisdiction on reservations. However, that has been eroded, as Congresswoman Moore is saying, and really undermined. And there are like bits and pieces that where tribes can prosecute, you know, they can do civil prosecutions, right? And as Congresswoman Moore was saying, you know, technically the feds are supposed to address serious crimes committed on the reservation against tribal people by non-tribal people. However, most of those cases are dropped. So it's like, yes, justice in name only, but not in reality. And so,
I mean, also as Congresswoman Moore has pointed out, like the federal authority who needs to respond could be up to 500 miles away. And so them coming for a domestic, I mean, maybe they'll come for a murder, maybe they'll even come for a rape, but them coming for a domestic violence issue is just, they are under-resourced, too far away. There's not enough officers to respond.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, something that Sarah Deer points out in our documentary is this idea that a lot of these federal officers actually got into the business to do interstate crime, to do money laundering, to do these big kind of corporate and complicated investigations. And so a federal agent then being assigned to respond to a domestic violence case is just not something that they were expecting.
Yeah. And along with the jurisdictional piece, I do think Oliphant has had a huge, huge impact on the level of violence facing Native women. But I do think that there are a lot of other pieces that influence, that Sarah Deer especially talks about. She's a professor, legal scholar, and tribal legal expert. And she really talks about how, you know, how this country is founded on slavery and basically genocide of Native American people and stealing of the land. And really rape of women of color is fundamental to the founding of our country. And white men had total access to women's bodies, you know? And I think that that deep, deep cultural misogyny that we still have today in our country is you still see it enacted on the bodies of women of color. And so clearly on Native American women, you see that too. Sarah Deer talks about how Native women are considered highly lucrative for pimps and sex traffickers. They can be marketed as different racial, ethnic minorities. You know, they can be Asian women, they can be Native American women, they can be Latina women. And, you know, you can sell drugs once, but you can sell women over and over. And you see Native women represented. They're such a small minority of the population, and yet they're highly represented in these kinds of cases. And I just think that there is so much racism in this country that is targeting Native people as less than, and basically we owe white people, we have access to these people. We didn't respect them in colonial times. Why would we respect them now? And I think that that really feeds in. You add that to the piece where they don't actually have legal protection as much as non-Native women do, and you just have this mess, you know, that is largely invisible to the rest of the population.
Right. And one thing that a couple of the people you mentioned featured in the film, you have six women who share their stories. And it brings up the point that even though we associate the word colonialism with something in the past, it's very much present and continued in the practices that are done today.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And Sarah Deer says something really poignant too in the film, which is, you know, ask an average American person to name a Native woman. All they can think of is Sacajawea and Pocahontas, who, while amazing, fascinating historical figures, are also, you could argue, their stories are characterized by the services they provided to white men, you know? And in a way, we, a lot of times Americans still think as Native people, as these kind of racial stereotypes, the Pocahontas or the, you know, a drunk degenerate Indian or some, these are kind of, you know, redskin mascots. I don't think you could get away with the redskins mascot unless you have these underpinnings of racism in the society. And we need to uproot that as well as make legislative change of the kind that Congresswoman Moore is working on. We need to do kind of big picture and then nitty gritty legislative stuff as well.
Right. So one of these big picture aspects is calling for tribal sovereignty. So Congresswoman, can you explain what that means and how this is interconnected with the power to end physical and sexual violence against Native women?
Oh, well, thanks for asking that too. You know, I think sovereignty is really, really misunderstood, maybe perhaps deliberately, but it was, as you mentioned earlier, it was a contract that was made nation to nation, the United States and these tribal authorities. And of course, we have broken practically every tribal agreement that we made. But sovereignty means that number one, Native Americans are citizens of their own tribes and have jurisdiction over themselves, and they're also dual citizens. And so I think that that's where the rub comes in, because there's so many areas of sovereignty. We're talking today about the basic sovereignty, women having jurisdiction over their own bodies. But when I want to talk about sovereignty in Native American issues, I'm talking about land, I'm talking about housing, I'm talking about the federal government providing state and local government funds that are equitable, as they do, you know, this is very much an issue. You know, you can't pave a road with the same sort of taxpayer benefits on Native American lands that you can. Student debt, Native American medical students to pay interest on their loans versus other kinds of students. You're talking about the environment when you talk about Native issues. You're talking about healthcare when you're talking about Native American issues. You're talking about family court when you're talking about sovereignty. I mean, it's everything. And there are so many areas. I'll give you a really good example that has an impact on my profession. Literally, up until 2 years ago, a Native American who ran for office and became, say, tribal chairman or on the council could not participate in the Social Security program. That's crazy. I mean, I'm a member of Congress and I participate in the Social Security program. So we fixed that. But look at how this literally, we punished people for providing representation to their people.
So what can regular citizens do to restore tribal sovereignty and jurisdiction and to help protect Native women?
Well, we can stop being ignorant, first of all. We have to realize that these were the first peoples. I remember my daughter went back to college after having her kids, and she literally struggled through one course because she had to study in Wisconsin Native American history. She said, "Mom, my God, look at all of these treaties that have not been honored, all of the trust relationships that have not been respected." And so learning, and I think so many people see Native Americans having gambling casinos, and they then decide, well, wow, why should the government, the United States government, give them anything else? They're making all these fortunes from gambling. That is not true. And number one, what they do with all these proceeds is they provide education for their kids. They provide jobs to people in the larger community. In my own community, Native Americans provide health care through the casinos. But still, that is not enough money to stand up all of their activities any more than it is possible for United States citizens to pave their own streets on their block, put street lights in libraries in their own communities from one stream of income. And Native Americans deserve this as well. I mean, why should a road stop at the end of a street because the rest is reservation land? They ought to be treated with some equity with regard to state and local taxes that are being collected, as an example.
Now, Willow and Brad, I'm wondering, what have audience responses been to this film, and what else do you call for in regards to a call to action outside of legislative changes that are spearheaded by Congresswoman Moore and other representatives in the U.S.?
Yeah. Can I just add something to something Congresswoman said? Because it was, I mean, one of the profound things that Sarah instructed us on when we were interviewing her was this idea that the reservations, of course, were not the brainchild of the tribal nations. And in fact, when the Fort Laramie treaties were signed, it was the War Department looking at, is it more expensive to give these folks a nation and a land and displace them and provide for their well-being in perpetuity, or would it cost more to stay at war with them? And they decided that the former was actually cheaper. And so it was an economic decision to sign treaties with these nations. And in the treaty, like the treaty with the Fort Berthold, with the Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara, it says that the U.S. government will provide for their health, their welfare, and their education for as long as the grass grows and as long as the wind blows. And so I just wanted to, reiterate what Congresswoman Moore was saying, that like we have an obligation to help provide social services and for the health and the well-being of tribal nations.
And I think I would just add, as Congresswoman Moore said, stop being ignorant. Like, if we could all educate ourselves more about, you know, read media and books, films, poetry, art, music made by Indigenous people, there's so much to learn. And I think that we all, you know, I've slowly come to understand, as a white person raised in the US, the air I breathe is racist in a way. You know, there's so much we have to unlearn, a whole lifetime of even growing up in a liberal bubble. We have to sort of like unlearn these implicit biases and assumptions, you know, that are kind of floating in the air about other kinds of people, and specifically all kinds of different people of color in the US. And I think that it just takes a lot of unlearning and a conscious work to root that, like pull that out by the root and throw it away and replace it with something much more accurate and hopeful and beautiful and inclusive and equitable.
And I mean, also to not be afraid to show up and know that you're going to show up imperfectly, make mistakes, learn from them, and then show up again. And I understand that it's sometimes a barrier there that us white folks or men like me are afraid to show up because they're afraid that they're going to make mistakes. But show up imperfectly and then show up again, for sure. And then as far as reactions go, I mean, I think we've gotten a wide range of reactions from non-Native folks. Probably the most common reaction is rage and anger and wanting to do something about this.
Outrage that this is happening and they didn't know about it. And so they really want to know what to do to improve the situation and rectify all these wrongs that we've done to Indigenous people over time, and also just make the world a better place and a safer place for Native women.
And then, I mean, we've gotten heart-wrenching reactions from Native folks who have seen the films when we've had the opportunity to talk
and
to them
survivors.
Afterwards.
Yeah,
and survivors,
a lot of echoing back kind of what Sarah Deer was saying, that there's so little representation of powerful, embodied Native women, you know, in media around you. Luckily, there's more and more, but just seeing these incredibly powerful, resilient survivors fighting for change in Sisters Rising has been really inspiring for a lot of audience members.
Right. And there's a quote from one of your subjects that says, "We are so indebted to women who have told their story." You know, the faces behind the numbers, the ones that help bring these issues to front, to help bring up legislative change. You know, did you start this project as a testament to that?
Yeah, I think, well, you know, it kind of took years of working on the film to realize why we were making the film in a way. For me personally, there is gender violence history in my family. And I think that unconsciously, I was working that out a bit in the work by educating myself by listening to all these Native women. I learned so much. They introduced me to the concept of historical trauma being passed, generational trauma being passed down. I'd heard about that in the context of the Holocaust and Jewish survivors, but I hadn't heard about it applied to other groups of people, and just realizing like, oh, this is my legacy. I'm making this film because of the legacy I have for my family. And I think that that was my personal subconscious reason to make the film, but also just living in Brooklyn. We were living in Brooklyn at the time, now we're in Vermont, but we were just, you know, Black Lives Matter was taking off, and Surge standing up for racial justice, we were kind of tangentially involved with, and just thinking like, we're white people in America. What the hell are we doing? We need to be doing stuff. We need to be standing up and making a change, even if it's imperfectly. We can't just, because doing nothing is contributing to the problem.
And, you know, I grew up all my life watching, you know, Native women being treated like squaws, and, you know, not really understanding the whole history of that. You know, and when I think about not just women who are subjected to domestic violence, but just the Indigenous women who are murdered and missing, and that just not this. You can be invisible. You know, some perpetrator who wants to kill women knows that you know, their best bet is to kill one of these women because they're just invisible. And just imagine the depression that you grow up with, knowing that you just are that, you could just disappear and no one will care.
Well, I know with your film, more people will start to see these women and hopefully also be a catalyst for change. So Willow O'Farrell, Brad Heck, and Congresswoman Gwen Moore, thank you all for joining me to talk about Sisters Rising.
Thank you,
Audrey. Thanks, Audrey.